President Obama makes nice with the private sector.
Now, is there any chance the private sector will start hiring?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It is Wednesday, December 15th. Coming up, a stable African country gets into the oil business. What will that do to its stability? And one of the nation's biggest banks calls for tougher rules on banks.
But first, President Obama meets today with CEOs at the White House. He's trying to improve his frosty relationship with the business community. Dan Cook is senior market analyst at IG Markets. He's with us now from Chicago to discuss. Good morning, Dan.
Hello, Jeremy.
Well, let's listen to something the president said just moments ago.
I believe that the primary engine of America's economic success is not government. It's the ingenuity of America's entrepreneurs. It's the dynamism of our markets.
So, Dan, the president's making nice. Is there any reason to believe that we'll get some serious hiring after this meeting?
Well, I don't know that this meeting necessarily will be the impetus that drives the hiring, but I do think we have several factors that are coming together. The government's is there and is going to continue to support that type of environment, and we've seen the Fed make that commitment. I think when we look at the cash on the balance sheets of corporations, there's a lot of room for growth, and I think once we've gotten through some of this uncertainty, we could see a much more promising year next year.
Much more promising year. Now, Dan, we got an indicator this morning about the housing market. The price of getting a mortgage, the interest rate average, is going up. Is there any way the economy can really recover if the housing market is going to remain in the doldrums?
Well, we can recover, and I think what we're going to face is kind of a new reality, we'll call it, in that we're going to have to live with kind of a depressed housing market. But I do think we've seen some signs of stabilization. The big shocks are over, and we can have a little bit of room to grow up from here.
All right, Dan Cook of IG Markets in Chicago. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.
Federal regulators are writing some new rules this week as required by the new financial reform law passed over the summer. Yesterday, the FDIC proposed some new banking rules, like one that requires banks to keep more cash on hand in case things head south. Marketplace's David Gura reports on the beginning of a long rulemaking process.
The Dodd-Frank law was passed this summer, and regulators have just a few months to shape the final rules. Rick Firestone is an attorney with McDermott, Will & Emery.
The rulemaking requirements that have been imposed under the Dodd-Frank Act are historical.
They're also unprecedented. The Securities and Exchange Commission alone has to hammer out nearly 100 regulations governing everything from derivatives trading to municipal bonds. Over the next few weeks, a bunch of agencies will look at debit card fees and new whistleblower provisions. Firestone says corporations have been dispensing advice liberally.
It makes for better rulemaking at the end of the day if those who are impacted by the law have expertise on the issues.
But with the GOP in charge of key House committees, regulators fear they may not get much funding. Attorney Steve Quinlivan is with the Leonard Street Law Firm. He says if that happens,
it's not going to be of much use in protecting the financial system.
In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Well, as regulators shape the rules, one bank is calling for tougher requirements to lessen the risk of another financial meltdown. The Financial Times today says San Francisco-based Wells Fargo wants banks to keep more loans on the books as opposed to selling them off to investors.
Marketplace's Janet Babin is with us from New York to talk about that. Good morning, Janet.
Good morning, Steve.
So what's Wells Fargo asking for?
Yeah, so Wells Fargo wants banks to keep most of their loans, most, on their own books as opposed to selling them. And this is ahead, of course, of the government coming out with new regulations. And under those regulations, banks might be required to retain 5% of their credit risk. Now, some mortgages might be exempt from those rules. Say if homeowners put a lot of money down on their loan, like 30% or more, banks might be allowed to sell off those loans if they could find a buyer of that debt at this point. I spoke this morning with bank analyst Christopher Whalen at Institutional Risk Analytics, and he says Wells Fargo has a reputation for being more conservative than its peers. I mean, Warren Buffett, that famously astute investor, is a major Wells shareholder. Whalen expects the government to follow Wells Fargo's suggestion here. He says it's the safe approach.
If I'm a banker and I can't sell a loan, I'm a little more careful about the loans I make, right? If I'm not going to sell it to somebody else. That was the problem that got us in so much trouble. Everything was originated for sale.
Janet, haven't banks been selling those mortgages for years, though?
That's right. That's right. That was the securitization craze. Banks, since the 60s, really, Steve, have been selling mortgages. And the money they made on those mortgages, they'd take that and lend to even more people so they could make more money. And that all came to a screeching halt, of course, during the housing bubble, when the values of some of those sold mortgages turned out, in many cases, to be worthless. And banks, including Wells Fargo, of course, had to borrow billions of dollars from the Federal Reserve to keep from going under.
Janet Babin in New York, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Marketplace's Janet Babin reporting for us this morning.
The GOP takes over in the House right after the first of the year, and sure enough, there will be some changes. One thing that could be on the chopping block, current Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's initiative to reduce the House's carbon footprint. Critics say the Green the Capitol initiative was a big waste of money. From Washington, here's Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer.
Some of the Green the Capitol initiatives included compact fluorescent lighting and recycling. But then there were the forks. A special House Green team ordered biodegradable cutlery for all the food outlets on their side of the Capitol. The forks broke and the knives wouldn't cut. There was bipartisan outrage. Energy lobbyist Jeff Holmstead says the Green initiative was mostly PR.
In terms of making a difference in the real world, it was not substantive.
Critics really went wild when the House invested about $90,000 in projects to green the Midwest. But environmental lobbyists say overall, the Green the Capitol program did save money. Scott Schlesinger is with the Natural Resources Defense Council.
Economically, it was a big plus for the Congress and therefore the taxpayers.
Schlesinger says all told, the two-year program saved at least $2 million. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, December 15th. I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. Now to the global perspective. What's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world? We got word today from the rating agency Moody's that Spain's credit score may get a downgrade. Yesterday, Belgium got a similar warning. Investors, yep, they're worried about Europe's stability again. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us now from the European desk in London. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Jeremy.
So why do these credit ratings matter so much?
Well, very generally, because a government's credit rating is pretty critical. A government with its tax raising and other powers is usually the most dependable financial entity within a particular country. Here's Jan Randolph of IHS Global Insight.
If you ask yourself, what is the most creditworthy institution in the country? Most people would say, yes, it's the government. So when the sovereign rating moves up or down, it takes everything else with it.
And Stephen, beyond just investor psychology, what's at stake here?
Usually a lot of money. I mean, investors are watching very closely the precise rating that's allocated to a particular country. It can be anything from the top, AAA, down to CCC, which is close to default. In the middle of this spectrum, you get BBB-, which is the point at which investment-grade bonds become much riskier. They become speculative or junk-grade. And that, says Jan Randolph, can have very practical consequences.
A lot of investors, pension funds, institutional investors, they have a credit policy which says we only invest in investment grade. And any downgrade into junk means automatic sell-off.
We're talking about all this, Jeremy, in the context of Spain and Belgium. But if a leading British fund manager is to be believed, a downgrade could be heading your way. He says that because of all its debt, the US could eventually lose its AAA rating.
Oh, great, Stephen. Thanks for leaving us with that one. Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Thank you.
Okay, Jeremy.
The African country of Ghana joined a very exclusive club today. That nation began pumping oil off its coast, an oil field the country hopes will bring in at the most $1 billion per year. The BBC's David Amanner is with us from a ceremony in the town of Cape Three Points to mark the occasion. Hi, David.
Hello. Hi.
Sounds pretty lively there. How are people celebrating?
Well, actually, what we're hearing here is a colorful makeshift amphitheater. And there's a giant screen here where we've been watching pictures of President Atta Mills aboard the floating production and storage unit, where he's been turning the taps on for Ghana's first oil to flow. So the music you're hearing in the background is Ghana's national dance ensemble, who've been singing and dancing in all the different traditional styles.
Let's change gears a bit, David, and talk about how important this could be for the economy. What are the people of Ghana saying about that?
Well, I think people here out on the streets have sort of tempered their expectations, but they do expect it to be a blessing. They do expect their lives to improve. So perhaps expectations might be a little high, because really, I mean, we're looking at a boost to the economy of between 500 million to 1 billion US dollars. I mean, you're talking about a 1.85 or to a 3.7% increase in the economy. And in the scheme of things, that's not really a lot.
Ghana, David, is known as one of the most stable countries in Africa. Is it concerned about how things could perhaps go sour with this oil exploration?
There are concerns in a way that things could go sour in a slow kind of way, that there are fears that, you know, oil could feed corruption maybe in the same ways that it has in Nigeria, Angola and Equatorial Guinea, and a widening gap between rich and poor. You know, there are several negatives to watch out for in the oil experience.
The BBC's David Amanner in Ghana. David, thanks.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Jeremy, the Swiss bank UBS has sent out a 52-page dress code to a handful of its retail banking branches. You want to know some of the suggestions?
Sure.
In this primer? Women should wear makeup. Apparently, it exudes confidence, the makeup does. And their shoes shouldn't be too tight. I don't know what that means.
What is that about?
I guess, loose shoes, makes for fewer frowns. and employees should stay away from tobacco, so no smoking, and smelly foods. They should keep away from smelly foods.
Well, that's not, feel like, if you're going to get a deal done, you probably don't want to have too much smelly food and tobacco on your breath.
And garlic and those Marlboros. You're right. You're listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, December 15th. I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. For the latest look at the markets, you can go to the numbers section at marketplace.org.
Looks like the United States may be ready to jump back into an industry it ceded to the Chinese a decade ago. This morning, the Department of Energy will be sharing its strategy on getting the country back up to speed on critical rare earth metals. Now, this week, a company called Molycorp got final approval to reopen such a mine in the Mojave Desert of California. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner from the Sustainability Desk got a firsthand look.
A year ago, I'd never heard of rare earth metals. This week, I found myself on a bus to Mountain Pass, California, taking Rare Earth 101 from Molycorp spokesman Jim Sims.
Didymium, as you'll learn today, is a combination of neodymium and praseodymium, and those are all used.
Forget the tongue twisters. What's important is we depend on these metals. They're in cell phones, hybrid cars, laptops, even jet fighters. China's been the dominant producer for years now, but it's cutting back exports. So Molycorp is preparing to reopen the only rare earth mine in the U.S. It's just off Interstate 15, an hour southwest of Vegas.
We're about 400 feet from the edge to the bottom.
General Manager Rocky Smith gives the guided tour of this open-pit mine. It's an impressively big hole in the ground, more impressive than the rust-worn buildings here that date back to the 60s. That's when this mine supplied the world with europium, the stuff that gave us vibrant reds on our color TV screens. But the mine closed in 2002, plagued by environmental problems and Chinese competition. When it reopens, Molycorp's promising cleaner operations and at least 20,000 tons of rare earths a year. CEO Mark Smith says that's more than enough to meet current U.S. demand, and there's room to grow.
We've only disturbed 55 acres after 58 years, and we own 2,222 acres. So we will be here for many, many hundreds of years.
A bit of CEO hype, perhaps, but Smith has reason to be giddy. Molycorp's stock price has more than doubled since July. But Agora Financial's Byron King says Molycorp has yet to prove itself.
This is a lot more like running Dow Chemical Company than it is like running, say, Barrick Gold.
King says rare earth mining and processing is complex chemistry, and the U.S. hasn't done it for years. Starting over again will no doubt test Molycorp's metal. In Mountain Pass, California, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
What's the most typical town in America? Well, 10 years ago, Marketplace's David Brancaccio used census data to find out it was a place called Cuba, Missouri. Well, David went back to Cuba to check in, and he's here with me now in the studio in New York to tell us about it. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
Why Cuba, Missouri?
Well, 10 years ago, the town was the statistical center of the U.S. population. And then some fresh data came in from the U.S. Census Bureau. It moved the center of population a little south and a little west. Here is Ray Mortimer, who's a postal delivery man and the current mayor of Cuba.
I think it's kind of middle of America. I really do. And I think we'd make a pretty good model because I think we are representative, yes.
So that's what he thinks. What did you find there?
Well, the town looks, I guess, spiffier. It's on old historic Route 66. They put up some murals as tourist attractions. But one economic planner told me that they didn't have irrational exuberance, right, during the good times. So not as far to fall these days.
Now, any place, David, that is claiming to be a typical American town right now would have to have pretty high unemployment, I would think.
Well, this is what the mayor told me about the effect of the recession.
No, we feel it. There's no doubt about it. We have to tighten our belt because we just can't be as lucrative as we were 10 years ago.
Yeah, well, they're not. Unemployment now, 10.3%. It is double what it was a decade ago, a little higher than the national average, too.
A little higher than the national average, but still pretty typical, I would say. Is it typical in other ways?
Well, 26-minute commute time to work, that is same as the national average. Unfortunately, more children living below the poverty line there. Houses are cheap, like $70,000 is the typical house price, $119,000 nationally, by the way. It's very white, Cuba, 98% Caucasian.
What are the other competitors for most representative place in the country?
Well, if you use a measure of well-being that factors in health, education, and income, Cuba's congressional district is worse than average, but right in the middle for well-being, so therefore typical, might be Florida's 15th congressional district. That includes Cape Canaveral, which is, I don't know, it's not a typical location, but in terms of well-being, apparently that area fits the bill.
Marketplace's David Brancaccio, he's going to be doing more reporting from Cuba, Missouri, and we'll have details on our Economy 4.0 blog at marketplace.org. David, thanks.
My pleasure.
And finally, Steve, while we're talking about the new American economy, I was the victim of credit card fraud yesterday.
What happened?
Well, somebody used my card to go do some holiday shopping online or something, and they charged up $1,000 or something like that.
Man.
I disputed the charges, and they're off my bill. So it's
That's not really that big of
a deal. But the bank said to me, they're going to send me a new card, the guy said, in 2 weeks. And I said, 2 weeks? You know, that's a long time. This is the holiday shopping season. I want to be able to use the card and buy something. And he goes, immediately, without missing a beat, he said, all right, fine, we'll send it to you in 24 hours. To which I said, I wonder if this means credit card companies are now even more desperate for us to spend than they used to be. I'm not saying they are, but I'm not saying that they aren't.
You're just asking questions, right?
I'm just asking questions.
That's what you're supposed to do, Jeremy.
That's right. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for being here for the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.